I like to say, my name is Frank McDonough. I work at the Arboretum. My official title is kind of a county thing, Botanical Information Consultant. I am also a licensed pest control advisor as well. And let me tell you how this came about. We were tasked with finding how climate change affects us directly. Now, there's a problem there. Climate change is very subtle, and its effects are very complicated. I'm going to tell you what we did to try to get some kind of a direct connection, and also what we're doing to deal with this climate change and its effects. And there's more than just climate change, believe me, on this too. It's going to be interesting. Let's talk about the garden first. The garden is 127 acres. We have over 14,000 plants, over 6,000 distinct taxa, of which 3,000 are orchids. We also have a large grove of endangered species, which was just made an endangered species in 2012, the Engelmann oak. And the Engelmann oak, I'll be talking a little bit about the Engelmann oak. It's a very weird oak. It's got some really interesting properties that you may not be aware of. This is the Engelmann oak, and that's our grove. It's always a gorgeous place. When I first came there, they were filming Mighty Morphin Power Rangers in it. And all kinds of strange costumed people would be walking around there. We've since kind of put a break on filming there and made sure that if they do film there in the future, they put platforms down to keep the roots from being compromised, because Engelmann oaks have very sensitive roots. We've had two trees die because somebody parked one truck underneath them. One truck killed a mature oak. And the reason that they are so sensitive is where you find them in pure stands like this. There's three places where they grow in pure stands: Black Mesa in San Diego, Santa Rosa Plateau in Riverside, and this pure stand, the northernmost, on top of what's called Talic Knoll. They all three places have one thing in common: shallow soil, maybe 18 inches, 19 inches. These are very well adapted to shallow soil. They have two different forms of roots. One goes deep and one goes shallow. And they also seem to really require a little extra summer rain as well. And if you look at the other two areas and ours, all up into the Tehachapis, you have monsoonal influence. What's monsoonal influence? Out there, that's monsoonal influence. Hot, lots of humid, and thunderstorms. Believe it or not, we do have thunderstorms in L.A., usually in September and October. Usually put down an inch or two of rain. If we get a hurricane, we get more. But we're working to expand this grove, now that it's an endangered species, from what it was when we got there to much bigger. And we're doing that. You notice the little flags there? Those are seedlings. We have to make sure that we have a very small staff as far as gardeners. So unfortunately, we have to contract a lot of our maintenance work out, much more now that we've banned Roundup. And we have to train, or at least let the weed whackers know that these are things to avoid. Before this, everything got weed whacked, and that would include seedlings. So we've been very successful. We've extended it now about almost an acre, and we're hoping for a few more. Now, the nice thing about the Arboretum, it's not a super formal garden, and it's got great feng shui. Anybody familiar with feng shui? Okay, feng shui, in my opinion, is arranging things so that you have less of a possibility of being jumped, attacked, without your knowledge. Nobody, if you have an area that's arranged in a very good feng shui manner, you can see people, things, animals approaching you, so you have some time to take evasive action. This makes you much more relaxed. If you're in an area that has high hedges on both sides and you can't see where the path's going, you don't feel as relaxed. And so that's why, if you're in an place that's very good feng shui. You can see your attackers coming for miles, and you can take evasive action, and you feel more relaxed. You can make better decisions about money, and fortune smiles your way. So, this is our Meadowbrook section, which is devoted to East Coast plants, and we have a collection of Chinese and North American woody trees and shrubs. And what's really fascinating about this, now, they aren't exactly the most climate appropriate, but they really, you know, we water them every 2 weeks, and they do fine. But the cool part about all of these, both North American and Chinese deciduous, mostly trees and shrubs together, is that during the fall, I'm going to fast forward a little bit. Okay. I'll come back. Okay, sorry. We have a beautiful fall display, and I'll show you that later on. Okay, this is our Canary Island section. And we have we let this grow kind of wild, and you can see those are Dracaena Draco, the dragon tree, and we've got those red flowers are aloe vera, which originated in the Canary Islands, and we have lots of status, Parisii status, and other status, species status, limoniums, excuse me, and all kinds of really neat plants, and this all seems to boom in a 3-month stretch in the spring. And so it's always in constant bloom. Now, why is that? The Canary Islands do not have one thing that California has and a lot of continents have. What's that? Huge herbivores to eat the plants. So the plants don't have the pressure on the flowers and the leaves. They can develop large leaves, and they can flower for a long period of time and not worry about their flowers being eaten off. So that's why they're such great ornamental horticulture subjects. We have peacocks. They were introduced, three breeding pairs brought over from India. They stayed around longer than any owner of the property has. They are actually considered a naturalized introduced species. We do not own them. They're like pigeons, only they look better. And they really bring a lot of people to the garden. And they make annual gardening really tough because they like tender leaves on non-toxic plants. Remember talking about the good feng shui? Water in the foreground, mountains in the background. The San Gabriels, by the way, are just a fantastic backdrop. They're a northwest trending range that actually came up through tectonic action from Mexico. And the only thing that keeps them up that high is tectonic action. If for some reason that tectonic pressure were to switch and go up, say, through Las Vegas instead of going up to California, these things would start sinking. Isn't that fascinating? Just more of the Canary Islands, by the way, because it's such a gorgeous area. See the echiums there? We have about 3 or 4 different species of echiums. And this is my favorite section. The southern part of Madagascar is underlined by caverns. That's my hobby. I like to explore caves. But that also sucks all the water from the top soil area. And so these plants have to develop strategies like swollen bases to hold water and nutrients, so when the short rainy season does come, they can explode with the growth of roots. Or those spines, which aren't there to protect them from animals, but are there to condense water from the fog that comes in from the close coastal areas. It is about 5 miles from the coast. And this collection we have is just... It's one of the best outdoor Madagascar collections on the West Coast. In fact, I can probably safely say that about a lot of our collections, that we have superlatives or close to superlatives on the West Coast. Now, that's what it looks like at night. Actually, I do a night photography class, and I just watched. That's me. You can see a shadow of a person there. I was just walking through, flashing a flash. So I do night photography class there too. Now, we have one section that's near our waterfall that is just loved by a lot of people, and that's, we always get calls, are your cherry trees blooming? This is the one single cherry tree we have that's of any note there. The rest are seedlings that we just planted in the last 5 years. The reason it does so well there is that this area here gets a very cold, we have lakes and water, and we get this inversion layer, and the inversion layer stays cold, and it actually chills this bottom part better than the top part. And a lot of times you'll see it, the top part will be, the bottom part will be flowering, the top part is just still coming in. It hadn't had enough chill yet. Now, does this look familiar? Anybody seen Fantasy Island?
Oh, yeah.
Anybody seen Meet the Fockers?
Yeah.
Just paint that a dull green and put very bad sculpture in front of it, and that is the Focker House. They filmed Meet the Fockers there at the Arboretum using this house. This was built by Lucky Baldwin. He was a hotelier. He was like, this was the Vegas of its time. They were surrounded by dry communities, but they sold liquor. They had horse racing and a few other things. And, you know, all of the communities around, the men would come down here. He would have guests that were high-end literary people like Mark Twain. He would have opera singers. And they'd stay in this house. This was their guest house for the big guests. He'd make a big deal that they're there. And people would come from all around with a good excuse because they're just enlightened. They're just increasing their literary retinue. They're not really just going down there to drink. So he was the Steve Wynn of his time, I guess you could say. We have a crescent garden. Now, this crescent garden, we use the principles of permaculture. Anybody familiar with the principles of permaculture? You know, by the way, we're just talking. There's one permaculture technique that actually looks pretty promising, and that's the cardboard mulching, the lasagna mulching. And it's a lot like the anaerobic fermentation that you do to sterilize soil for strawberries. This technique is the only thing I've ever seen completely, like 99% controlled nut grass. It really works well. It works better than spraying, which we can't do anymore because of that. This is the view from the top of Talig Knoll. Talig Knoll is that area where the we have the Ingeman Grove. Oh, by the way, I'm telling you about shallow soils. Talig Knoll and most of the Arboretum has a layer of hardpan deposited sometime in the past. It's about 3 or 4 inches thick. No water can get past it. It's the reason we have the lake, because it acts as a natural liner. And it's the reason that that's a pure stand of Engelmann's, is because the soil is only 18 inches deep, and they're the only oak tree that can compete there, or can do well there. And they're not competing with the live oak. All right, this is our natural water feature. This is a water feature that has been, it's one of the few freshwater features that's perennial in Los Angeles. It actually has had, and historically had fresh water for 10,000 years. How do I know this? We excavated just above this feature, and guess what we found? 6-foot layer of peat. This stuff was black. You could burn it in ovens. It was that rich in carbon. Peat doesn't form unless it's anaerobic conditions, and anaerobic conditions don't form unless you have continual water. So, and we are the best place to watch birds, 250 species plus have been observed there. And that's because for 10,000 years, this is like a freshwater source stopover for them. And there's some of those are mallards, I do believe. But our big draw in the fall is our fall color display. These are ginkgos. Now, this little area where the ginkgos are, it has that inversion, so it gets nice and cool, and it kind of evens out the heating and cooling, so you have a nice turn of color in the whole area. And people come from all over the place just to see our fall color change. And we're featured in californiafallcolor.com. You can check that out. It's a site that has all the California fall color watchers, the leaf peepers, and all of California. And we're always prominently displayed. And finally, we've been on a little bit of a roll in that we've been doing very good with attendance. And one of the things that helped with attendance is this Lantern Festival. Now, the Lantern Festival is a company in China. They bring in these beautiful silk lanterns. They put them up, and people come in, and they were expecting maybe 110,000 people. They were over 150,000 people. And the reason is that the lanterns and the plants together dampen sound like crazy. So you can have 100 people in a small area, and it doesn't feel like it because there's no echoing. And finally, remember I was telling you about how half of the tree blooms and the other half doesn't? There it is. That's our waterfall. Anybody seen Wayne's World? Yes. The last part of the first Wayne's World, where Tia Carrere, Rob Lowe, and Michael Myers are duking it out for each other's affections. Well, that's where they did. They shot the rock video, kind of.
She's got that boa constrictor.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. Also, Beyonce's Survivor videos, and Katy Perry's Roar video, and it was in the late '80s. Every hair band you can think of was there, with bikini-clad models up and down the. Anyway, we do a lot of, because we're so close to Hollywood, we do a lot of that stuff. So let's get to what I was going to talk about. That was nice, but let's get to the depressing stuff now. Maximum and minimum temperatures plotted over time for Pasadena, California, from 1894 to 2017. This is pretty telling. There you go. There's the minimums. You see they're going up about 7 degrees, maximum about 4 degrees. Maximum's going up less than the minimums. That's a good thing. But this is real data, and that's a real rise in temperatures. And so, you know, any doubters? Now, that being said, how much of this can we attribute our current woes to? That's the problem. So let's take a look. Oh, there's the LA average temperature, up 5 degrees since 1880. So let's take a look at the disasters we've been having at the Arboretum, and we've had quite a few. First, the 2011 windstorm. Oh, this is a beaut. And I lived in Arcadia, and it sounded like a jet plane was taxiing right out in front of my apartment when this thing was going on. Just, you know, anybody been to a hurricane?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm probably not impressing you at all. So our max winds were about 120 at certain areas. They were 80 to 90. Now, those are hurricane force winds, and we did have them sustained. So we did have a lot of damage. Let me show you what happened here. I got up in the morning, and I had to walk to work. And this is what I saw on the way to work. Now, does anybody know why those trees are falling besides the wind?
Shallow roots.
No, their root plate has been compromised by the sidewalk. There's a thing called a root plate, which is a certain area you need around a tree in order for it to stay upright. Do you know what the number one thing that keeps trees up, by the way?
No.
They're the force of friction. And the force of friction is proportional to their mass. So if you trim trees to make them better for the wind to go through, you're actually making them more likely to fail. Nobody gets this. Nobody gets this. It's like I'm a tiny voice in the wilderness. Let's hear the violin. Little violins for me, please, everybody. Okay. But anyway, it was pretty bad. And then I came to work, and this was work. The parking lot. We only close one day a year normally, and that's Christmas. And that's just tradition. And we had to close. And this is what it looked like inside. It was even worse. And winds over 100. We had them 120. Sustained winds over 70 miles per hour. Over $50 million in damage. And here's a neat effect I found out about that Talek Knoll. Talek Knoll was built like a wing. It's like, you know, slightly curved. The front part is steeper than the back part, and the winds were coming from over. And so there's a thing called Bernoulli's principle, where winged surfaces create an increase in velocity of the wind. And so the wind on there was 120 plus, and it did this funny thing. It did a sideways on the ground vortex. And so it literally, I don't know if I can have a picture of that. See this one right here? That literally exploded. It was on the top of the wing, and the winds were coming at it from 120 miles in two opposite directions, and it just went, boom. That's a ficus macrophylla, by the way. It was a ficus macrophylla. So we found out something about Talek Knoll is that you don't want to put really large trees on top of it. Okay, Pasadena lost over 1,200 trees, Arcadia over 500. We lost about 230. Now, when you say we lost trees, because we kept a lot of them for material to propagate, and some of them actually came back. Yeah. So, but what to do? Well, let's first see if climate change is a factor. Hard to say. This area has a history of high winds caused by the topography. The San Gabriel Mountains are the highest mountains in the area, and where we are in Arcadia, does not have a lot of the constant Santa Ana winds because of that. They act to block the winds. But if you get a situation where you have, I think in that case there's high pressure on both sides and low pressure right there, right above the mountains. You get a situation like that where the wind is pushed over the mountains like toothpaste, then you have real problems because it goes down all those slopes and it increases in velocity. And by the time it gets to where you are, you're out of luck. There's several historic mentions of events just like this. Not all of them in the San Gabriel Mountains. In fact, Armstrong, who was John Armstrong, founded Armstrong Garden Centers and also Armstrong Roses. He was forced into the rose industry not just by the crash of the citrus industry, but a huge windstorm that hit Ontario, which is below the San. I think they're below what the San Gabriel Mountains there too, and they had the same kind of windstorm, 120 mile per hour, did a lot of damage, took down houses, and so there is historical. And plus, I did some research, and most researchers feel that, or some researchers, I'm sorry, feel that climate change will dampen the severity of Santa Ana winds and winds in general in Southern California. Why is that? That's because we're just a different area. Southern California's got so many weird things going on as far as weather. It's hard to say what's going to do what. So whether that's right or not, who knows? The fact is, though, we can't attribute this to climate change 100%. What about the 2011-218 drought? 7 years of drought. Anybody been through that? Anybody here experienced that personally? Yeah, it sucks, doesn't it? This is our lake. Our lake historically hasn't dried. Now, here's the thing. It's not just the climate change. A lot of it has to do with the change in houses and people. Arcadia gets its water from groundwater. Our lake gets its water from groundwater. It's an artesian spring that comes up and fills this lake, which is naturally lined by that caliche layer I was talking about. And guess what? A couple of things have happened. One, that caliche layer, during the filming of these great Hollywood films, and a really dumb idea of taking a caterpillar out on the lake bed when it was dry to dredge it, have compromised that layer. And so this lake, it goes dry just about almost every year now. And two, the local houses, here's one of the problems, and I hope they're starting to address this. We have a lot of spec houses in Arcadia. There's a lot of houses that aren't, there's nobody in them. They're huge, like $1 to $5 million houses. And they're there just to wait till somebody wants to buy them for the right amount. Spec houses. 250 plus. If you look at Zillow, don't take my word for it, look at Zillow and see how many houses are for sale. And when they do these houses, what they do is they find an old house, put a new house there, and they'll put new systems and new landscaping and new irrigation, and guess what they leave the irrigation on? Whatever default the irrigation's on, which is usually every night. And so there you have irrigation on 250 houses going on every night. That's a problem. So Arcadia's finally doing something about it. They are facing some pretty massive fines if they don't. And maybe it'll help our lake out, but there's more going to the lake. Also, you notice how shallow that is. It's always been a marshy but permanent lake. It was dredged by Lucky Baldwin to make it more good-looking for his clientele. But that dredged lake has now filled up with sediment and needs to be dredged again. We just got, luckily, the Board of Supervisors, because this is a very important area, it's a bird sanctuary, it's a stopover for migrating birds. It's a feature that's been there 10,000 years with water in it at all times. They just gave us some dollars to actually get this fixed, which, thank God. I don't know if they're going to be able to do it. One of the other things they've done is they graded the area and all the drainage that used to go through the lake and help scour out the lake and keep it clean. They have a very large drainage area that comes through the lake. And that would, every winter when we have rains, it would come and scour out all the mud. But that doesn't happen anymore. They're not going to be able to do anything with that. But they are going to reline it. They're going to do a few things, and hopefully they'll get it fixed. That's what it looks like when it's full. It doesn't take long because it's only like 2 feet deep. Now, another thing we've been that's happened to us in this last drought, because it's been so severe, is our water table has gone down below where tree roots can get to it. And this is not a problem for a lot of the collection that's been planted since the 50s, because we irrigate it. This, on the other hand, is a tree that was put here back in the 1870s. We don't even know if Lucky Baldwin put it in. It might have been put in before when a gentleman named William Wilskill owned it for a while. This is a blue gum, very old, probably 130, 40 years old. And that's what happened to it. Yep. Because our water table, which is usually 50 feet and above, gone down below 100 for a couple years straight. This tree, which had its roots, now you can water this tree till forever with a hose. You're not going to get enough water to it because it's got its water in a huge reservoir, and that reservoir is gone. So that's what happened. Now, what do we do with this, the windstorm stuff and all that? Well, we had a fundraiser. We gave the wood out to artists and had them make stuff out of it. We did this twice. The most successful fundraisers we've ever had. We cleared, you know, we grossed $100,000 for both of them, you know. And what we do is they give the stuff to the artist, they give it back to us, and we auction it off, they get a percentage, and the rest go to us. And that, look at that. See that guitar right there? That wood is Dawn Redwood. Dawn Redwood is called music wood in Chinese. Why? Because it makes some of the most incredible musical instruments. And guess who got to actually play that before it was sold for $3,000? This guy. It was the most beautiful experience ever. So if you ever see one of these, you're not going to see them too often. When Dawn Redwood's on the endangered list, nobody's going to take down their ornamental Dawn Redwood because they're too beautiful. And we were just lucky. So is the drought due to global warming? Now here's the rub. Drought has been more frequent historically. There was a paper in 1990 that looked at sequoia tree rings, found out that it was more frequent and severe before 1850, and then from 1850 to 1950, it was less severe. So we're in a period between normal droughts. Yay. So this is not even thinking. Global warming might help in this case, in that when you need CO2 to the atmosphere, you're actually increasing the atmosphere's ability to hold energy. And when the atmosphere can hold more energy, it can hold more rain. And there's a chance, there's a lot of people who think that we're going to get more rain because of global warming here in Southern California. Because we have more El Niños, more warm water off the coast. There's a lot of things that are bad for too, by the way. But you'll get more hurricanes, more monsoonal influence, and we may even, although nobody knows for sure. The whole thing is, there's so many variables involved. That's one thing I was trying to find. Let me tell you, on this study, I was trying to find solid numbers that I could show you. Look, there's a direct relation. No, nothing. What about insects? Well, anybody familiar with degree days? Yeah. Well, the increase in minimum and maximum temperatures are going to increase the degree days for a lot of insects. Not all of them, but a lot. And those insects that have short degree day requirements for breeding cycles are going to increase. But how can you tell? You know, there's so many other factors that are involved in insect infestation. But that doesn't help. That goes against us and not for us. So let's look at a couple of them, see what we can say. Glassy winged sharpshooter. Anybody familiar with this guy? Efficient spreader of any kind of bacteria that's a fastidious or xylem infesting bacteria. They're great because they feed with the xylem, and so that means that they there's a lot more volume going through them, and they can get, instead of just virus like the aphids do, they're slackers compared to this guy. This guy pumps tons of water in and out of the plant, or actually tons of bacteria in and lots of water out their rear ends. By the way, I was just out. We were having a concert. I was waiting at the food truck to get some food, and it was raining, from the leafhoppers on a eucalyptus tree, just coming down like crazy. So when they get going, they really let you know. So, well, let's see if that Yeah, I think that degree days will probably affect this one because look at the number of degree hours they need from ninth to adult. Not a lot. You know, something, I think, a long period of degree days, which are hours, by the way, that are figured out through a... Anybody ever go, why do they call them degree days when they're more closely related to hours? Anybody ever give that a thought? Anybody know why they do that? I don't know. It's just to confuse people. And there's all kinds of different formulas, by the way, to do degree gauge because the curves that we're looking at for the optimum versus the not-so-optimum temperatures are all different for different insects. So, and well, not all different, but they're different for different insects. So
the original one was a degree day. It was the maximum minimum for the day average. That's what it's called, a degree day.
But now it's number of hours. Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah. It's really an hour. But anyway, we're getting more of those because of the rise in temperatures. But we're also getting a rise in maximum temperatures, and for some insects, that's a cap off. And that, you know, the maximum temperature they can go to is not as tall as the maximum that you might have from global warming. That's not going to happen in LA for too long. I mean, it's not hot enough yet to kill off most insects, but it will probably get there. So there's something good to look forward to, right? Oh, this is scorch. Scorch is, we thought it was going to wipe out the oleanders. It wiped out just half of them, and the other half are just laughing at us. It's, oh, here's the thing about scorch, too. It affects magnolias. I have no idea why magnolias were planted to such a great degree in L.A. Does anybody know why? I mean, they do well for a while, but they're southeast, okay?
Sure.
They need lots of water. Dry conditions don't do well by them. So take a look at that tree. How many things can you see wrong going on with that tree?
Yeah. Sidewalks,
too close. Too close, yeah. Okay, and not only do we have Xylella, it's on the hose list, but the shot hole borer introduces Botrysperia into it. And that's what you're seeing. Mostly, a lot of that's Botrysperia damage. What's that? Well, you see the flagging? Yeah. The flagging's Xylella, but there's dead stuff in the middle. That's probably bot. Usually, I see these dark streaks coming down the tree. I'm pretty sure those are bot spores, but I could be wrong. They could be Fusarium, too. Fusarium's not that great for the tree as well. Yeah. The bottom line is, when you take a tree from the southeastern part of the United States, where it rains every day in the summer just about, and you put it in L.A. and it does well, there's something that's not going to last in that equation. Longhorn borers. That was the reason that this... The longhorn borers were the primary reason why this died. But longhorn borers tend to affect eucalyptus that are under drought stress. Now, is global warming or the increase in minimum temperatures and maximum temperatures going to hurt these things and do anything about these? They're two or three generations per year, and they're probably not. Two or three generations is as much as they do, and then that's it. They still do a lot of damage, but you're not going to see an increase in generations most probably from the temperature rise. So some insects, a lot of the borers are included in this, they have two generations or one generation per year, and no matter if the temperatures go up and the degree hours go up, it doesn't matter because they're just going to have that one generation and that's it. Oh, now here's my favorite. Anybody having problems with this one? Anybody worried about this one? Yeah, it does attack avocados, but apparently it moderates after a while, which makes sense. I mean, any kind of invasive insect like this doesn't want to commit suicide. You know, they don't want to kill themselves off, and generally the really, really bad ones kill themselves off, and then you just kind of, it's moderating on the population. Anyway, this is found... Akeef Eskelin first saw this in avocados, wasn't too sure what the significance of it was. Then he came to an entomological society meeting, which I saw. I was there when he got crazy about this. It was so fun. And he saw a Coleoptera tree that was full of hits. You know, Coleoptera produce an amber-like resin to deal with the insects, and the Coleoptera is all kinds of amber resin coming out of it. So he peeled down into it and used his knife and found these guys. That is the polyphagus, now the just called the invasive shot hole borer. because now we have two species of them, and it looks like they came from both Taiwan and from Vietnam. And they probably came in on boxes, wooden boxes that weren't treated. And so it's been quite a problem for willows. It's doing a huge amount of damage on sycamores. And generally, most riparian trees seem to have a problem with it, especially native riparian trees. And this is what it looks like on the right. That's what it looks like on avocado. This is a dead stump of an avocado. Look how far in those galleries go. And here, that's the real problem with this thing, is they cause huge branches to fall off. About 3 years into this, the federal government came to me, and the Department of Health, Human Health and Safety, I think. Who takes care of worker safety for the federal government? OSHA came in, and they brought me this sample, and it was this stuff on sycamore. Apparently a tree guy made his anchor rope on this huge branch, looks fine to him, and it failed because it was riddled with these galleries. So this is not just a pernicious economic pest, but it can cause fatalities too. And this is what it looks like on an oak. See how deep those galleries are in? Yeah, I know. They go quite, and the reason they're in so deep is that they don't eat the trees, they eat the fungus that they bring with them. They bring three different types of fungus. The most common one is a fusarium. And on trees that are susceptible to the fusarium, they can just die within. Well, we had one Brazilian pepper that was infested with these guys, and it went within a year. And it was the sawdust coming out of it was amazing. Now, for some reason, again, it's probably because the really aggressive ones, they kind of filter themselves out. But it's still a real problem. It's still a real problem. And there's no really good solution to it. Other than the avocado growers are really lucky that it does seem to attenuate down over time. You know, just so it doesn't kill itself off. So who's to blame for this? Well, decrease in container inspection due to the homeland security issues. Large, by the way, has anybody been to the international airport and seen the beagles? Finally, you know, they're finally getting some more inspection going, but they're not inspecting what they really need to inspect, which is all those containers coming in. Large reservoirs susceptible hosts, especially castor beans and willows. Highly irrigated landscapes, they love water. I did a study with thermal imaging in these little buggers, and when they hit oaks, the area that they're hitting is warmer than the rest of the oak, because the oak is metabolizing a lot to produce phenols to drench into the area and kill off the insects. That's what the oaks do. But the sycamores, on the other hand, they've got something going where somehow their xylem tissue causes flooding, and it floods the insect out. These little buggers love it. It helps, it increases the amount of fungus that they can grow, and it's just, it's perfect for them. And wherever I would see an infestation on a sycamore, it would be cooler. In fact, we actually drilled into one sycamore that had a cool streak, and a live Ewellacea, a live shot on board, came out of it. It was pretty cool. So, can we attribute this to global warming? Well, yeah, it could. There could be some increase in the amount of infestation because of the degree days. They have a low. Their degree days are about 780, and I think they can get 10 to 11 generations. If with the increase in global warming, you can increase that 2 to 4 more. So, yeah, there is some effect of global warming. And here's another study that was done on a different pest that talks about, this is a multi-generational pest, and he found that it was the increase in maximum that increased the number of generations more than the increase in minimum. And luckily, our increase in maximum hasn't been as severe as the increase in maximum. So I guess that's a good thing. Effect on bloom time. This is where I just went crazy. This is where you ever try to study something and you're banging your head on the table because you cannot get any decent data? This is my bang on the head moment. Back in the Arnold Arboretum, Abraham Miller and Rushing et al., they used photographs and herbarium specimens of different plants, especially magnolias, to show that, yes, over time, These are blooming earlier and earlier in the season. Hence, a correlation with global warming. So I said, oh, we'll just do that over here at the Arboretum. Ha ha. Well, first off, try to find some decent records anywhere that are more than 10 to 20 years old. It's impossible. And I found out that our record system is, we have a 5-year cycle. I knew that, but I thought maybe, but our deaccession records, which are records of any death of a tree, they're at a 5-year cycle too. That doesn't really help. Also, photographs. You know, most photographs are film. They're dated when they're developed. Who knows when they were taken? You may have some notes, you may not. I wasn't able to get any sufficient data on old photographs. And finally, let's see, well, magnolia is the one that I thought I would have some luck with. No luck at all. And even the only really good dating you can get with magnolias is digital photographs. And they've only been around in any significant number since the 2000s. And that's just not enough time to show a trend. And so that was out. What about the Sierra Madre Wisteria, which they've been having this Sierra Madre Wisteria Festival, where everybody gets together, the wisteria is blooming, let's have a party, and significant parties, since the teens. This huge wisteria is one of the largest, supposedly according to Guinness, flowering plants in the world. That's up for debate, but that's what Guinness says. Now, that's not the Sierra Madre Wisteria, that's our own little wisteria. Most of the photos for the Sierra Madre Wisteria are copyrighted, but that's what they look like. So what did I find out? Well, boosterism has been around since before the turn of the century. And what that means is they don't want to tell you when it's actually blooming because they want you over for the festival. And so it was impossible to get accurate records of when it was blooming. On to another thing. We had some luck. My assistant was working for me. He said, I talked to the poppy fields. They have somebody who has been keeping records. They're only keeping records for the last 20 years. And the poppy seems to be blooming later than sooner. And it turns out that California poppies, the wisteria here in California, the number one significant factor for getting the bloom is water, not temperatures. Yeah. And there was no way I could get this in to do the math for the graph, so to speak. But from what I can feel, it seems that our rainy period has been shifting toward the summer and not the opposite way around. But that's, again, that's just a conjecture. It's not a fact. Anyway, nice picture of California. Has anybody seen this bloom this year, the California poppies? Freaking amazing. It's the best thing I've ever seen in my life. I've never seen one better. And this is not even at the Poppy Preserve. This is east of the Poppy Preserve at Antelope Acres. Private area that they just leave open. It's beautiful. So what's the conclusion? The effects of rising temps on our collection are difficult to determine using statistical analysis. Record-keeping inconsistency and many variables that come into play make designing a study that is conclusive a challenge. Has anybody ever had that problem? And although the Arnold did this successfully, we don't have that kind of records. And the Arnold's collection, they have snowfall. So the snow stays on the ground, then it melts and they bloom. So they have a different set of conditions than we have. You know, we don't have snow. Our plants bloom when there's significant water and they're not as crazy about the temperature as much. And that's it. So I just spent a good 45 minutes of your time giving you terrible results. I hope you don't kill me. I hope you understand. All right. I did actually do some research on this. There's a lot of stuff out there, and unfortunately, record keeping is terrible out there. The weather records, thank God for them because they are accurate. But you know, when it comes to ornamental hort, if you find some really decent records, let me know. I'd sure love to use them. Any questions? Yes.
How about Phytophthora and Eggman Oaks? Is it a risk?
We had one problem with Phytophthora. This is it. This is how we found out that the Engelmanns grow in a shallow soil. We had some Phytophthora, some Engelmanns dying from Phytophthora. We cultured it, did a parf on it, Phytophthora. And finally we figured out
Phytophthora remorum? What species?
Not sure, but it was Phytophthora.
Okay.
And here's the interesting thing. It was not a situation that was normal. What was happening was that layer, we had Boy Scouts cleaning out, there's a pond, I don't know why there's a pond on top of Pelican Knoll, but they put a pond on top of Pelican Knoll. And Boy Scouts clean it out, and they take the sludge and they put it on the top of the hillside. The sludge goes down to that layer and just starts moving downhill. Well, that's a highly acidic sludge that makes for a nice anaerobic layer that just Phytophthora does well when it's not competing against other microorganisms. So it killed off all the competing microorganisms. And once we, you know, once we realized that, we realized that if we just had them put the stuff, we didn't throw it on the trees anymore. We just put it someplace else, and we haven't had a problem with it since. And the interesting thing too, I've noticed that they don't get oak root fungus to any great degree. They don't seem to have a problem with it. I'm pretty sure now that oak root fungus is symbiotic with oaks, because it kills off all the competition for the oaks. We've taken live oaks out that are shot through with it, just shot through with it, and nothing. And did you know that eucalyptus that you saw? That was shot through with it too. It was running up the trunk, and I can't tell you for sure that it was armillaria, but it had this everything going for it that said armillaria. It went up 50 feet up the trunk, in the wood, involved in the wood, and yet the tree was fine. And I saw this about 15 years ago, kind of when I first started. I thought, my God, this got armillaria, it's going to die. So armillaria, armillaria may be more of a symbiont than it is a pathogen. That's just my opinion. I don't have any numbers to back it up. Neither do I have the research budget. Any other questions? Thank you for listening. Thank you. You're all invited. Come on by.
Yeah, up in the Redwoods, they don't quite get the fall color that I would like. So, thank you so much. We appreciate your time. One of the other great things that we get to do for the industry division is I solicit funds. I beg for funds. And thankfully, we have companies that are able to provide some funding for travel grants for grad students. So, this year, I think we had 12 or 13 people. I know that. We were a little bit late in getting out the announcement and things like that, so we have really tough decisions to make. I was able to get enough funding to get, instead of just a single $1,000 check, to get four $500 checks out, particularly since this is Las Vegas. I thought, wow, it's not as expensive to come here, and maybe they can use some of the money to go gamble, maybe they'll make more. maybe you can pay off this to it. Well, luckily, horticulture students have assistantships mostly, and they don't have a ton of student debt, but unless you have credit cards, then you take out the loans to pay off the credit cards like I did. So we have four people this year, and I wanted to acknowledge them and hand them their checks. So, the first one, in no order, I think this is in alphabetical order, but Constantinos, tell me how you see your last name? Patsiakis. So, thank you so much. And I know you're sitting right here, Manan Kargar?
Yes.
Okay, team, hashtag, here you go.
No, that's where we are.
Okay, good.